where the sunny weather made them all feel it could be summer now, and they should be outside. Nathaniel Moon sat halfway back in the classroom. He knew the answer to the question, as he had become interested in the Oregon Trail over the summer, and had read a number of books about it from the Middle Falls Library. He tended not to raise his hand and answer the questions, though, unless he sensed that Miss Haywood was fed up with calling on Mary. He was reading ahead in their textbook, looking to see if there was anything in there that he hadn't read over the summer. One of the books he had read had told him that there were spots where the ruts from wagon wheels were still visible, and he hoped to see a picture of such a place. Behind him, the largest boy in the class, John West, looked over his shoulder and watched him turning the pages of the textbook. Saying that John was the largest boy in the class was a vast understatement. John was the largest boy in the same way that Alaska is the largest state. Both are true, and both are true by a lot. He wasn't fat by any means, just large. His father was 6'4 and 240 pounds, and his mother wasn't much smaller. John was already looking like he would eventually pass them by. Miss Haywood was just about to give up on the waiting game and call on Mary when the bell rang, dismissing the students for the day. The moribund students sprang to life as though electricity zapped their posteriors.
"Please read chapter 18 in your history textbook so we can discuss it tomorrow," Miss Haywood said, over the scraping of chairs and chatter of conversation. Few heard her, and fewer still paid her any mind. The last two students to leave the classroom were John and Nathaniel. As John left, he glanced over his shoulder and saw that Nathaniel was speaking to Miss Haywood. Speaking not really as a child speaks to a teacher, but almost as an adult who had wandered into an elementary school classroom. John shook his head and lingered outside the classroom, watching him. John had been watching Nathaniel all school year, trying to figure him out, and he hadn't come close to succeeding. Most kids, it was easy to figure out what their thing was, to be a jock, or a brain, or just trying to skate through school until real life kicked in after a few more years. Nathaniel defied all easy categorization. He was kind and bright, but was not easy to push around or bully. Nathaniel saw that he and Miss Haywood were alone in the classroom, but continued his conversation with her. He had noticed that she had grown increasingly sad over the course of the year, and now, near summer break, she had seemed to not care about anything at all. Nathaniel saw her glance up at the clock, so he excused himself to leave, but before he did, he reached out and laid his hand on hers, a gesture of childlike innocence. He returned to his desk, put his books away, then retrieved his accordion so he could take it away for his lesson and left. Miss Haywood sat at her desk marking papers for an extra half hour. When she stood to go home, her back was straighter and her step lighter. She even hummed a little tune as she walked to her car. 90 minutes later, Nathaniel emerged from Mrs. Jacobson's house. Irma Jacobson was in her 70s, widowed, and happy for the business, as there weren't many people interested in accordion lessons in the era of Madonna and Michael Jackson. Nathaniel was so thin, he nearly didn't cast a shadow, but he nonetheless lugged his heavy accordion case down the trail toward home. There were sidewalks between Mrs. Jacobson's house and home, but the trail was a shortcut, and what 10-year-old boy can resist a shortcut? Ahead of Nathaniel, two other boys sat on their haunches, looking down into a stream that moved so slowly it might have been mistaken for a long, skinny pond.
"You see anything, Craig?"
A sandy, blonde boy with a pug nose and freckles shook his head.
"Nah, Bobby says there's bullfrogs everywhere along here, but I think he's full of shit."
The second boy, stocky and dressed in a dirty t-shirt and jeans, got bored searching for frogs and looked up the trail. He nudged Craig, who squinted and said,
"What's he carrying? It's bigger than he is."
The second boy said,
"I think it's an accordion case. He takes lessons."
Craig looked at him like he had two heads.
"Shut up, Wimmer. No one cares. Accordion lessons," he snorted. If that's not asking to get beat up, I don't know what is.
Wimmer shut up.
Come on, let's have some fun.
Nathaniel looked ahead and saw the boys coming toward him, but he kept on at the same steady pace. Eventually, he stood right in front of Craig and Wimmer, who blocked his path. Nathaniel took the opportunity to set the heavy case down with a small sigh of relief. He grinned at the boys.
Hello. Hello,
Craig said, mocking Nathaniel's adult-sounding way of talking. Craig was a talented mimic, which he used as both self-defense and as a vicious attack.
Hello,
he repeated in the same tone, then looked at his friend expectantly. Wimmer laughed appropriately, but he was surprised when even Nathaniel laughed.
What the hell's wrong with you, Moon Pie?
This was a nickname he had hung on Nathaniel earlier in the year, but it had not gained as much traction as he would have liked. Nathaniel gave the question some consideration.
Glad to say there's nothing at all wrong. Well, there's gonna be something wrong. What's in the case? It's an accordion.
Wimmer nodded wisely.
I knew that, he said quietly.
Craig shot him a look out of the corner of his eye.
Dude, it's 1989. No one plays the damned accordion unless they just want to get their ass handed to them.
Nathaniel looked at Craig with a confused look and replied,
I disagree. I play one, and I don't want that.
Wimmer laughed again, but this time it was with Nathaniel, not at him. Craig flushed red, took a step back, and threw an elbow up into Wemmer's midsection. The oof that came out of him cut off any further laughter.
So you're a smartass, huh?
I don't mean to be. I do have to head home now, though. My Aunt Andy is waiting for me.
My Aunt Andy is waiting for me,
Craig mimicked. Nathaniel didn't react to the mocking, but just reached down to pick up his heavy case. As he did, Craig put both hands on his shoulders and shoved hard. Nathaniel stumbled backwards 3 steps, then 4, and pinwheeled his arms as his feet reached the small bank that ran along the edge of the creek. He eventually lost the battle with gravity and plunked butt first into the creek, splashing dirty water everywhere. As he fell, he glanced at the accordion case to make sure that it was still safe. Clothes will wash, I will wash, but Mom can't afford another accordion. He picked himself up, wiped his hands on the front of his shirt, and stepped up on the bank.
What you gonna do now? You gonna cry?
Nathaniel looked at him levelly. Nothing to cry about. Just a little water.
I do feel bad for you, though. Craig laughed. You feel bad for me? I'm not the one dripping wet and about to go into the drink again.
Craig took 2 steps toward Nathaniel when an old bicycle blurred in from the side, skidding to a halt and scattering gravel on him. Craig jumped back in surprise. When he saw who was on the bike, his eyes widened.
Jesus, West, you almost hit me. What the hell?
The boy on the bike wore his blondish hair in straight bangs, and even though he was only 11, he had wisps of future sideburns already growing. He leaned forward on the rusted handlebars. He squinted one eye closed and said,
What's this kid ever done to you?
He bugs me.
Because he's not an asshole? Because he's different?
It was obvious that Craig had never considered why anyone deserved to have their ass kicked. If they had an ass, and they weren't one of his friends, he kicked it. He was simply playing his role in the ecosystem.
Whatever, West, you're a weirdo too.
He backed away, out of range of John's long arms as he said that, just in case. He turned to Wimmer.
Let's blow, it stinks around here.
West continued to lean forward on his handlebars for a minute, while he and Nathaniel watched the boys retreat. Finally, he swung off the bike, let it drop, and took 3 strides to where Nathaniel stood, still dripping muddy water on the ground. He extended a hand. Chapter 14. Nathaniel shook John's hand and said,
Nathaniel Moon, thank you. It would have been all right. He might have pushed me in a few times, but I don't think he would have done much worse than that. Still, it's nice not being any wetter than I am.
I think I might need to teach you some self-defense. so people don't push you around like that.
I guess it would be fun to learn, but I'm not going to fight. That's just not my way.
Uh-huh. Okay. Can you rent a bike? John asked.
Nathaniel smiled, but shook his head.
Nope. Always wanted to learn, but haven't yet. Mom gave me the choice of a bike or that.
He pointed to the accordion case.
For my last birthday. Can't have everything.
Not sure you made the right choice there. Just curious, but why in the world did you decide you want to play the accordion? Are you a big Weird Al Yankovic fan?
No. Pretty big Frankie Yankovic fan, though.
Who?
Frankie Yankovic was a great accordion player, but he's not related to Weird Al, even though they share the same last name. Kind of a weird coinkydink, right? I like both of them, honestly, but...
Nathaniel noticed John's eyes were beginning to glaze over. He had often seen this happen when he talked about polka music, which was an inadvertent tag-along with some of the other memories he had brought forward.
Never mind. I don't know why, really.
Nathaniel got a faraway look in his eyes.
I saw an accordion player on TV a few years ago, and I knew right then that I wanted to learn to play it, too. There's just something about the way all parts of it work in harmony together that makes me happy.
That's pretty weird. John shrugged his shoulders.
There's a lot of weird things about me, Nathaniel said.
Me too, John said quietly. Someday, I'll tell you about some of the weird stuff that's happened to me.
I'd like to hear it. I'm a collector of weird and wonderful experiences.
I know a joke about accordions. Want to hear it?
Nathaniel's eyes lit up.
Yes.
A local band had an accordion player. One night after a gig, they stopped for dinner at a little cafe. They had just sat down and were getting ready to order when the accordion player slapped his forehead. You know, like those guys in the V8 commercials?
Nathaniel nodded, looking like he was ready to laugh at the punchline before he even heard it.
The guy says, "Uh-oh, I forgot to lock the car," jumps up from the table and runs out to where his accordion was. He opens the door and looks in, but it was too late. Somebody had already left two more accordions.
Nathaniel laughed as though that was the funniest joke he had ever heard.
Mental note, John said. Nathaniel Moon really likes stupid jokes.
I do. Do you want me to tell you one?
John shook his head.
No, not really. Look, you climb on the bike, I'll hold onto the handlebar, and make sure you don't fall.
But my accordion.
I've got it.
John leaned over and effortlessly picked up the case. He held the bike out to Nathaniel, who climbed on with a grin. By the time the boys arrived at Nathaniel's house, they had already discovered that, aside from their differences about the accordion, they both loved all three Indiana Jones movies and The Simpsons. As they walked the bicycle up the driveway that ran beside the house, they were showing off their impressions of various characters. Nathaniel did a passable Marge, but the best John could muster was Homer's, "Dope!" He swung his leg off the bike.
"Thanks for letting me kinda ride it. That was fun. You want to come in and meet my Aunt Andy? I know she'll want to meet you."
Nathaniel reached for his accordion, but John said,
"I got it. Sure, let's go in."
Nathaniel ran up the stairs and burst through the door.
"Andy, I'm home."
"Well, it's about time, mister," she said, coming around the corner from her bedroom. "Did you take the long way?"
She stopped short when she saw Nathaniel's dripping wet pants, shoes, and jacket. Not to mention the hulking boy standing behind him.
"Oh, what happened?"
She cast a suspicious glare at John, ready to go into attack mode if needed.
"Oh, not much. Some kids wanted to make fun of me because of the accordion. John came along and stopped them. Oh, by the way, this is John."
Nathaniel slipped his shoes off.
"Doesn't look like he stopped them to me. You're soaked. Go get changed right now. Put your play clothes on."
Nathaniel ran toward his room, wet socks leaving damp footprints on the wood floor behind him. Andy sized up the man-child who had apparently rescued Nathaniel from further dunkings. She smiled and said,
"Nice to meet you, John. You managed to avoid the water?"
John smiled and nodded.
He wasn't big enough to push me in.
He looked at Andy and said,
Georgia?
Andy was used to people picking up on her accent, but not children, even oversized ones.
No, Arkansas. Still obvious, huh?
John shrugged.
Not really, I just like accents, that's all.
Andy chuckled.
Why do I have a hunch you and Nathaniel are going to hit it off?
The door opened behind John and Violet came in, lugging a raincoat, a purse, and a yellow bag emblazoned with a logo of the local Mexican takeout. She entered talking.
Don't know why I ever trust the weatherman around here.
She saw John and said,
Oh, sorry. I didn't know Andy was having friends over.
John looked a little embarrassed, but Andy said,
No, no, this is John. He's a friend of Nathaniel's. It looks like he saved Nathaniel from being bullied on the way home.
Bullied again?
Violet sized John up, smiled, and said,
Well, fine. Thank you. Can I reward you with an enchilada or a...
She rustled through the yellow bag.
A bean burrito?
Thanks, but no. My mom's got dinner waiting for me at home. I better go.
Thanks for saving Nathaniel,
both Violet and Andy said together, as though they had said it many times before.
No problem.
He looked at them seriously.
He's a cool kid.
Chapter 15 Nathaniel's odd family unit was nearly complete. Mother Violet, once babysitter, now Aunt Andy, and best friend, John. The only thing needed to complete the picture of domesticity was a huge, slobbering furball, which, coincidentally, was exactly what Nathaniel and John found one day a few months later as they walked home from school. John had started leaving his bike at home so they both could walk home together. They rarely took the direct route home, but instead wandered whichever way their feet took them. Topics of conversation ranged from Nathaniel's observations on the human condition, which were met mostly with nods from John, to an in-depth analysis on whether the Seattle Mariners would ever field a 500 team. The team had never managed it in their decade-plus of existence, but since Nathaniel loved to root for the underdogs, the M's were the perfect choice as his favorite team. They walked down Dover Street, a mixed-use area that ran parallel to the main drag through Middle Falls. The boys were walking past an alley that was lined with several dumpsters when they heard a woof and the thumping of large feet toward them. They peered into the darkness of the alley and saw an astonishing creature. Not a dog, exactly, but something more like an easy chair crossed with a mop. There were likely eyes buried under the long, floppy fur, but they couldn't be seen. The left ear pointed skyward, and the right straight ahead. A magnificent tongue wagged from one side to the other with each bound of the animal. John took a half step forward and laid an arm across Nathaniel's chest, as a parent might do when braking in a car. The protection was unnecessary, though, as the lumbering animal skidded to a stop directly in front of them, sat on its rear haunches, and looked at them. Its expression seemed to say, I thought you guys would never get here. I've been waiting forever.
That is the funniest looking dog I've ever seen,
John said.
Yeah, Nathaniel agreed. Ain't he something? He's beautiful.
John looked at him slightly askew.
Something, all right, but I'm not sure what. Come on, let's head for your house.
Sure, sure, just a minute.
Nathaniel leaned down in front of the hairy beast and brushed the hair away from its eyes.
There you are.
He patted the head and petted the neck, and the dog's tail thumped against the sidewalk. Finally, he put his head against its neck and buried his face in the matted fur.
Nathaniel, you're grossing me out. God only knows where that dog has been. I can smell it from here.
Yeah, it smells pretty bad. This is my dog, though.
What? Oh, Andy and your mom are going to love that.
Not at first, but eventually they will. Let's go home.
Nathaniel turned toward home and set off at a steady trot. The dog padded along at his heels as if on an invisible leash. John shook his head and followed along behind, muttering, "I gotta see this." At home, Nathaniel threw the door open and led the parade into the living room. Violet was sitting on the couch reading and looked up with a smile to welcome Nathaniel home. The smile froze on her face and slowly fell into a concerned frown when she saw the behemoth behind him.
"Well?" Nathaniel said.
This scene plays out 1,000 times every day, across America and the world. A child brings a stray dog home, asks to keep it, and the parent says no. In most households, the child moans, begs, and pleads, and the parent either relents, and there's a new addition to the family, or doesn't, and there's an unhappy child until the scene plays itself out again sometime later. The Moon household was not most households. Violet looked at Nathaniel, then the slobbering, smelly dog behind him. John froze behind both of them, observing how the drama would play out. Violet sighed and said, "We need to have an understanding." Nathaniel nodded and, as if replying by rote, said, "I'm responsible for the dog. I have to give him a bath every Saturday, and more often if he stinks, like he does now. I have to feed him and walk him, and if he makes a mess in the house, I have to clean it up. If he's not a good member of the family and I can't control him, we'll have to find him a different home."
"Are you sure, Nathaniel, about this particular dog, though? If you have your heart set on a dog, we could go down to the Humane Society and see all the dogs there that need homes. I'm sure there are some, smaller dogs there. This one is a behemoth."
Nathaniel laid his hand on the dog's head, who repaid him by slathering the hand in saliva.
"You're right, Mom. There are. And I know a smaller dog would be easier, and they all need homes, too. But we can't save all the dogs. Just one."
He looked happily at the mountain of fur beside him.
"This is the one for us."
Andy walked in, carrying a mug of tea. She noticed the immense dog in the middle of the room and stopped, splashing hot tea over her hand. This made her jerk and cry out in pain, which spilled more hot tea on her, which made her drop the mug onto the hardwood floor, where it shattered into a dozen pieces.
"Sorry, Andy," Nathaniel said, then looked at his mom. "I'll go get a towel and clean that up, but I don't think it should count against Brutus."
Violet started to giggle.
"Oh my God, really, Nathaniel? Brutus?
It's his name."
An hour later, John and Nathaniel had managed to bathe Brutus, which was an adventure in itself. He didn't fight going into the bathtub exactly, but he didn't help either. By the time they got him wet and lathered up, the two boys were both as wet as the dog. When they unplugged the drain, the bottom of the tub was covered in yellowish-white clumps of fur.
"I think from now on when I give him a bath, I'm just going to change into my swimsuit," Nathaniel said.
After he was allowed out of the tub, Brutus gave a shake that threw water over the entire bathroom, floor to ceiling, drenching the boys yet again. After they toweled him off, Andy and Violet appeared with brushes, combs, and clippers. Andy had taken hairdressing classes at the community college, so she took the lead in the operation. They spent more than an hour rotating around Brutus like he was an Indy car pulled in for a pit stop. Andy clipped the matted fur where it couldn't be combed out, while Violet and the boys brushed at the sections they thought could be saved. Through it all, Brutus stood, tongue lolling, patiently waiting for a better part of his life to begin. In the end, Brutus once again resembled a dog, if still a giant, homely dog, who would never be beautiful. With a single exception, once the matted fur was removed from his face, two lovely, soulful brown eyes looked out at the world. It was hard to look into those eyes and not love him. Cyrus Creech spun his chair around and looked out his office window. Creech Coat and Uniform Manufacturing had undergone many changes over the previous 6 years. He had closed the original factory in Tubal and moved his family north, closer to Little Rock, His business had expanded and exploded during that time, and he was now the CEO of a much larger concern. The growing business didn't mean he had forgotten about Nathaniel, however. Creech still thought about him every day, and his frustration grew with each passing month and year. He had fired JR when no noticeable results had resulted in the first 12 months, and was now working with a fourth agency, trying to locate Nathaniel and his mother.
"It's almost 1990,
he screamed into the phone at the last report.
"People don't just disappear. They're out there, and I will find them."
The investigation and search for Vivian and Nathaniel Hanrahan had cost Cyrus more than a small fortune, but with the success of his business, he hadn't even noticed the drain. He continued to write out checks each month while pursuing each new angle, idea, or lead. He had thought the investigators were closing in on them twice, once in Durango, Colorado, and once in Oceanside, California. Both turned out to be false alarms. Cyrus's attitude toward both Vivian and Nathaniel had also evolved over the years. Once he had believed that Nathaniel's gifts came directly from God and should be used for his glory. But the longer he was frustrated in finding them, the more he ascribed negative connotations to Nathaniel and his strange talent.
"Perhaps it wasn't from the glory of God after all," he would say. And if he were truly of God, he would share his miracles with the world. And somewhere, he no doubt bears the mark of the beast.
These were Creech's words and thoughts on the surface. But deeper, where the truth of his life was, it was simply frustration at his inability to find them, and most importantly, to a man who seemed to have total control in his life, the fact that he could not control them. Chapter 16. 1995. For the next 6 years, things ran as smoothly for Nathaniel, Andy, Violet, and Brutus as they ever did for any family. There were minor blips, of course. Andy had a hard time holding a job long-term, because she hated being away from home each day. Her heart was in being a homemaker, and she always managed to find a way to make that happen, again and again. Violet was once again rising through the ranks at her job, though, so they didn't really need Andy's income to get by. Nathaniel lost interest in his studies sometime during his freshman year in high school, and brought home a semester report card with 2 C's and a D on it. Violet was flabbergasted. Nathaniel so often did unusual things, but they were more in line with floating a few inches off the bed when he slept, or astutely cutting to the heart of a debate with a few quiet words, as opposed to failing tests. When Violet asked him why he brought home such a poor report card after 10 years of exemplary ones, Nathaniel was honest, but that was not surprising. He seemed incapable of lying. Not the outright lie, or a lie by omission or partial truth, or even the always popular white lie, designed to save someone's feelings. However, Violet had told him that when he was older and his wife or girlfriend asked him if he liked her haircut, or if her jeans made her butt look big, the only 2 correct answers were, respectively, "Yes, I love it," and "No, not at all." Nathaniel had filed these instructions away with a marker to remind him of when to use them. So when Violet asked him about the report card, he said,
"Because I didn't care. What we were studying was too simple and boring, and I just decided not to do the work."
"But we want to have all options open for you when you are ready to go to college, so you need to get good grades the rest of the way."
"I've decided I don't want to go to college. I've spent too much time sitting in a classroom already. I'll finish high school and I'll get good grades because it's important to you. But I'm not going on to college. The job I want to do won't require a degree. Just empathy and a strong back."
Vivian contemplated asking him what that job would be because she knew he would tell her, but decided to leave that question for another day. Nathaniel had taught her many things by example, one of which was, don't borrow trouble,
It will find you, if it must. Beyond these small blips, life proceeded apace. As soon as they had arrived in Middle Falls, Violet had found a job as a receptionist at a medical center. 9 years later, she had worked her way up to assistant director, and if you asked anyone who worked there, they would tell you that they went to Violet first with every problem. On Halloween night, 1995, the smooth path they had enjoyed for years became twisted and bumpy. Nathaniel was 16, John had just turned 17, and both were too old to go trick-or-treating. Violet had asked them to stay home and watch Jamie Lee Curtis scream her way through Halloween, but the boys weren't interested in that either. Watching that movie on that night was a tradition for Violet and Andy. But this year, Andy was saving up for a new stereo, and so had one of her intermittent jobs, delivering for the Leaning Tower of Pizza. John and Nathaniel decided to walk around town and see what they could see, although they didn't put a lot of effort into their costumes. Nathaniel found a long blonde wig and a pair of black-framed glasses. John tucked his hair behind his ears and found a Wayne's World baseball cap, and they transformed themselves into Garth and Wayne. Of course, the real Wayne wasn't a hulking 6 foot, 3 inch, 225-pound teenager, but Nathaniel had been working on his mimicry, and he had Garth down pretty well. More than anything, they just wanted to be out and about, watching the kids trick-or-treat, stopping by Sammy's Corner Grocery for a Coke and a bag of Twizzlers, and hanging out with each other. The highlight of their night was when they saw four guys dressed as Kiss. They bowed repeatedly, repeating, "We're not worthy," and cracking themselves up. Eventually, they tired of the limited fun a small-town Halloween could offer, and headed back to Nathaniel's house. Andy had promised to bring a giant pizza home with her at the end of her shift. "We're too early," John said, nodding at the driveway at Nathaniel's house. Violet's Toyota Camry was there, but Andy's older model, Mazda, was not. Nathaniel shrugged and hurried up the steps. "Well, hopefully we stayed gone long enough that Mom has watched her movie. Maybe we can find Night of the Living Dead on until Andy gets here." Nathaniel threw open the door and would have been bowled over by the attack from Brutus if John hadn't been standing at the ready, bracing his shoulders. "Sorry, boy. This just wasn't a good night to be walking around with a giant shaggy dog. It would have taken all the attention away from our awesome costumes." "Hey, Mom," he said, plopping down on the couch. "Where's Andy and the pizza? We've only had dinner and a bunch of candy and pop while we were out. We're growing boys." The phone rang, and Violet said, "She was supposed to get off half an hour ago. I'll bet she had to make some late deliveries, and that's her." "I've got it," Nathaniel said, sliding across the kitchen floor in his stocking feet. He picked up the cordless phone, extending the antenna in one smooth motion. "Hello, Moon Residence." The smile faded from his face. A short pause, then, "Mom? It's the hospital. They're asking for you." Violet vaulted up off the couch and was across the room in 2 seconds. "Hello?" She listened intently, then said, "We're on our way." She dropped the phone, clattering under the counter. "Shoes on. Andy's been in an accident. Let's go." Chapter 17. John left for home and let the Moons go to the hospital alone. As much as he was part of the family, Violet's expression told him that she wanted it to be just her and Nathaniel. In the car on the short ride across town to the hospital, Violet was quiet and focused on driving. When they pulled into the emergency room parking lot, she turned the engine off, but didn't immediately open the door. Looking straight ahead, she said, "They didn't tell me how bad it is, but from their tone I'm afraid it might be serious. I'm hoping she's just got a broken bone or two, and we can take her home soon to heal up. But prepare yourself for something more than that." Nathaniel nodded, laid his hand on the door handle. "Then let's go." Violet reached out and touched his shoulder, holding him back. "When you were just a little boy,
I asked you to not use what's inside you. To not heal anyone, unless we talked about it.
And I haven't, at least not much. And things have been good. You were right.
Mom, you don't have to say anything.
I know.
If Andy is in bad shape, I will help her.
You haven't done it in so long. I was afraid you would have forgotten it, or couldn't do it.
When you say things like that, I know you truly don't understand this, but that's okay. You don't need to.
It would be easier to forget how to breathe.
Sometimes I wonder if I was wrong. I was afraid. You are so special. I've been afraid that someone would try to take you away from us.
It's okay. If it was something I really wanted to do, I would have just talked to you about it. But I just want to be what I've been. A normal kid, living a normal life. If I had helped every person that was sick, that life would have been over pretty quick.
Now that I hear you say that, I feel selfish for worrying about it. But let's worry about that later, honey. Let's go and make sure our Andy is okay.
They hurried into the ER entrance and to the admissions desk.
Can you tell me what room Andrea Moon is in?
The woman at the desk consulted a computer monitor, then said, 106, just down the hall on the left. Violet and Nathaniel hurried down the hall, checking the numbers on each door. When they spotted room 106, there was a doctor wearing a white lab coat and talking to a nurse, who was holding a chart and making notes. When Violet tried to push past them, the doctor held up a hand to stop them.
Can I help you?
I'm Violet Moon. I'm looking for my sister, Andy.
The practice lie slipped easily off her tongue. The nurse melted away, but the doctor reached out and touched Violet's elbow. He indicated a small waiting room.
Let's sit down over here so we can talk.
Violet opened her mouth to object, but Nathaniel said,
Mom, he probably has the answers we need.
And they followed the doctor to a small semicircle of chairs.
I'm very sorry to say.
As soon as Nathaniel heard those words, he looked up at the ceiling and closed his eyes. He calmed his heart rate and breathing. When he opened them again, the doctor was saying,
We did absolutely everything we could to resuscitate her, but she was already gone when they brought her in.
Violet's head dropped. When she looked up, her face was wet with tears, but a cunning look played across her face.
Doctor, is there any way we can see her, spend a few minutes with her? She's our only family.
Of course. We'll be moving her soon, but take whatever time you need with her.
He stood, said,
I'm very sorry.
And hurried on to other patients. She pushed the door open and found the room as quiet as a tomb. All the machines and monitors had been turned off. A small lamp on a bedside table cast a feeble, yellowish glow. Andy lay in the bed. The wreck, while traumatic, had left her face clear and untroubled. For all the world, she appeared to be sleeping.
Oh, Andy.
Violet struggled for control. She looked to Nathaniel, eyes pleading. She said only two words.
Can you?
Nathaniel, still a boy to all outward appearances, met her eyes and said,
I can, but I don't know if I will.
But this is our Andy, our dearest Andy.
Nathaniel smiled, a cheerful smile, and said,
Almost everyone is someone's dearest. Still, there are times they need to go, and we need to let them go. I remember that.
Violet nodded.
You'll know. I trust your judgment.
That's what she says. What she means is, she's sure I'll do what she wants. Just an hour before, Nathaniel had been wearing a silly Halloween costume and cracking wise with John. Now he was asked to make a decision that went somewhere beyond the border of life and death. He sat on the bed beside Andy, picked up her hand, and held it between his own.
It was cool, but not yet cold. He closed his eyes and reached out for Andy. Initially, he saw and felt nothing but blackness. But then, in the far corner of his consciousness, he saw her. She was just a small glimmer of light at first, and she was so far away. But as he looked at her, Andy drew nearer. Soon enough, she stood in front of him. She glowed with happiness and vitality. "Hello, Andy." She wrapped her arms around Nathaniel and kissed him on the cheek. "I've been lingering here waiting for you, but it has been so hard. I'm being pulled away, and I want to go." "Of course. That is the way of it. Violet asked me to find you and bring you back." "I knew you could bring me back to that life, but that's not why I waited for you. I was sorry I didn't say goodbye." She touched his cheek. "I love you, and you know I love Violet. I am so grateful I got to spend this time with you. You both brought me so much happiness. You are my true family, and I know we will see each other again. Will you tell Violet how much I love her, but that I chose to go on? Of course, she knows how you feel. You've shown her every day, in all the small ways you took care of us. But I will tell her." Andy reached down, took both of Nathaniel's hands in hers. "Thank you for letting me go. If you had wanted me to, I would have stayed." "I know. We'll hold the happy memories of you in our heart forever." Andy let go and took a few tentative steps backward. Then she shot her hands straight up, giggled with happiness, and disappeared. Nathaniel stayed where he was for an unknown time, cherishing Andy and her perfect spirit, then opened his eyes. Violet had moved to sit on the bed as well, and sat looking back and forth at him, then Andy. "She wanted me to tell you how much she loved you, and how happy our time together was. But she's gone now." Violet turned to focus on Andy's empty body, as though she might have the ability to bring her back where Nathaniel had failed. Finally, she turned her attention to Nathaniel. "Why would she ever leave us?" "Because," Nathaniel said simply, "it was time." Chapter 18. 2018. Nathaniel was as good as his word. He had gotten straight A's for the rest of his high school years, and graduated a very respectable 22nd out of his class of 175. That was typical of Nathaniel. He enjoyed performing and excelling, but he much preferred to stay out of the spotlight. John had to work much harder to get essentially the same grades, but he had never been afraid of hard work. He graduated just ahead of Nathaniel, and that was good enough to get him accepted into the University of Oregon. Victoria did her best to not compare Nathaniel's apparent lack of ambition to the more fired-up John, but she struggled with it. She knew that Nathaniel could accomplish absolutely anything he wanted. So when he told her that what he wanted was to be a janitor at Middle Falls Hospital, she was crestfallen. Nathaniel was steadfast in his desire to work at the hospital, though, and over time, Victoria had come to accept that it was a place where he could accomplish much good, while still living the non-headline-grabbing life he had chosen. In 2002, John had returned from the University of Oregon with not only a Bachelor of Architecture, but, much more importantly, a new bride. He and Melissa had met during his second year and fallen in love during his third year. They got married back in Middle Falls over Christmas break, John's final year at the university. In 2010, they had a beautiful baby girl they named Kate, but everyone called her Katie. They asked Nathaniel to be her godfather, of course. In the years that John was gone to college, he and Nathaniel stayed as close as ever. Nathaniel drove to Eugene for big football games, and John came back to Middle Falls every chance he got. Nathaniel, meanwhile, continued to work the swing shift from 3 to midnight as the night janitor in the critical care wing of Middle Falls Hospital. Even though he didn't get home from work until after midnight on the nights he worked, Nathaniel was a habitually early riser, up before the sun most days. He needed very little sleep and loved spending hours in the recording studio he had built in the basement of his little house. His love of the accordion had given way first to the steel guitar, then acoustic guitar, and eventually various keyboards and drum kits. He had spent the last year trying to learn to drum like Max Roach, which is like picking up an electric guitar and trying to learn to play like Eric Clapton. He knew it wouldn't happen, but also knew it was more about the journey, anyway. Nathaniel composed music and recorded it on the 16-track mixing board he had bought secondhand. Like the rest of the house, he and John had done all the work themselves, from soundproofing the walls to running the wiring and installing acoustical ceiling panels. It had only taken them a few years to get it the way Nathaniel wanted it. Now, he had a perfect little room where he could record by himself or with friends. The music he made was a combination of jazz and new age with the flavor of Mexican polka thrown in somewhere. It was not commercial music, certainly, which didn't concern Nathaniel in any way. He recorded for himself and piped the music upstairs, where it played whenever he was home. Visitors often had strong reactions to the music, ranging anywhere from a horrified expression to a few who were initially repelled, but eventually gave into its charms. When faced with these reactions, Nathaniel would switch over to more mainstream Chilean flute music or the like and say, "My music is an acquired taste, like anchovies." Except, eventually, some people learned to love anchovies. Nathaniel had a few life mottos. Chief among them was, "What other people think of me is none of my business." Another was, "What is right and what is easy are rarely the same thing." The one he had written on a piece of cardboard and stuck above his mixing board said, "Everything is impossible until you see someone do it." Nathaniel lived several miles outside the city limits of Middle Falls, on a small plot of land that had been created as a flag lot when several other plots of land had been subdivided. That gave him the advantage of having a smaller, less expensive piece of land that was surrounded by 20-acre parcels on all sides. His nearest neighbors were a quarter mile away in any direction, which gave him the privacy he cherished. Nathaniel had bought the land on a contract when he was just a year out of high school. However, he had continued to live at home with Violet for 2 years after graduating, so he could pour all his modest salary from the hospital into getting the land paid off as quickly as possible. As soon as he managed that, he bought an old travel trailer, dropped it on the property, and moved in. As soon as John got back from U of O, he went to work for a small architectural firm in Middle Falls during the day, and he and Nathaniel designed the house that would eventually go on the property. They spent many nights in John's small apartment, talking and dreaming over the plans, while Melissa occasionally brought the woman's perspective to the proceedings, which was much needed. Nathaniel lived in the travel trailer for 5 years, and grew most of his own food in the rich soil behind the site of his future house. During those years, Nathaniel saved his money. His goal was to be able to build the house, including all the improvements to the land, and own it free and clear the day it was completed. Nathaniel would have been content continuing to live in the travel trailer, but he had to admit that when you owned a dog the size of Brutus, a little more space was more than a luxury. When Brutus lay down in the middle of the floor of the tiny trailer, Nathaniel had to resort to elaborate gymnastic maneuvers to get around him. Not to mention that it was getting more and more difficult for Brutus to get up the tiny metal steps into the travel trailer. Because of the way Nathaniel had found Brutus, he had no way to know how old the dog was, but by 1999, he knew that Brutus was at least 11 years old, and almost certainly older. He noticed that Brutus was moving slower. His joints were stiffer, and his eyesight was failing. Every dog lover knows and dreads the pattern of a dog's life. that eventually the suffering of the dog outweighs the potential grief at losing a companion. But other dog lovers did not have the options that Nathaniel Moon did. When the day came that he knew Brutus was suffering, Nathaniel sat in the grass with him and laid a hand on top of his head. Brutus closed his eyes and laid his massive head on Nathaniel's knee. His trusting brown eyes looked into Nathaniel's. Nathaniel couldn't talk to Brutus, of course. He wasn't Dr. Doolittle. But he did what he could to communicate with him. "What do you want, my constant friend? For me to make you young again, or to be released to whatever is next for you? You have been such a positive presence in my life. I would miss you if you were gone, but I want to do what's best for you, for your mighty spirit." It would seem that having the power to deny death and restore health would be a wonderful gift. But Nathaniel knew the truth of it. Long extended life, even a pain-free life, was not always desired, and the law of unintended consequences always raised its head. He had vowed to never extend the life of anyone or anything without knowing if that was what they wished. They sat together for long, silent minutes, soaking up the sunshine, Nathaniel stroking Brutus's ears and scratching between his eyes. 5 minutes later, they both stood, but this time, Brutus's joints were no longer stiff, and his rheumy eyes had cleared. He put his head down between his feet, shook his head, and woofed like he hadn't done in years. When Nathaniel had fixed Pup Spittin' years before, he was too young to know, but whoever or whatever Nathaniel fixed stayed fixed. So it was with Brutus, who would never have so much as a touch of arthritis for the rest of his exceptionally long life. Now, so many years after they had first found each other, Brutus was as young and healthy as he had ever been. He still jumped up into Nathaniel's pickup truck when it was time to go for a drive. And he still spent happy hours fruitlessly chasing rabbits and squirrels behind the house. From the road, Nathaniel's house looked modest, and it was in many ways. Middle Falls was famous for having a high water table, so basements were rare, but the soil on Nathaniel's property drained well, so that had given him the perfect place for his dream musical studio. Above ground, the house was small, 1,100 square feet, although it was only that big because John insisted on it. Left to his own devices, Nathaniel would have had a much smaller footprint.
"I know you could live in a space the size of the travel trailer, but eventually you might want to have a wife, and she's not going to want to live in a house the size of a closet. Besides, you need a second bedroom so that when your best friend crashes for the night, he doesn't have to sleep on the couch or, God forbid, a hide-a-bed." Nathaniel laughed at the thought of his bulky best friend attempting to sleep on a hide-a-bed with a metal bar firmly across his shoulders. He relented, and John designed him a lovely two-bedroom house with a great room concept, built around a massive river rock fireplace and an A-frame window that looked out on the forested hills behind his house. The house was small, but the finishes and flat surfaces were straight out of Property Brothers. The day Nathaniel and John packed the last of the tools away and vacuumed up the last of the sawdust, they sat on the patio on the back deck and enjoyed the accomplishment of something they had built with their own hands. They each nursed a beer and watched the sunset behind the tree-covered hill. Nathaniel tipped his Budweiser toward John and said,
"Thank you, brother, for everything you did. It's perfect. Without you, I would still be living in the travel trailer. Seems like you've been doing me favors since the first day I met you down at the creek. I owe you."
John nodded.
"I'm sure I'll cash that all in someday, when one of your songs hits the top 40.
They both laughed at that ludicrous idea. Sitting in rickety lawn chairs, squinting into the setting sun, John took a long look at Nathaniel and said,
"There's something I've been meaning to tell you all these years. I almost told you that very first day, when you got dunked in the creek, but I didn't. And then I just never knew how to bring it up. Today,
putting the finishing touches on your house. Seems like the time. Are you up for an unbelievable story?
Chapter 19. John took a long drag on his beer, crumpled the can, and fished another out of the cooler that sat between them. Nathaniel sat quietly, staring out at the hills.
This isn't my first lifetime.
I don't think this is the first lifetime for any of us, John.
My first life was both the same and completely different, if that makes sense. I mean, I was born here in Middle Falls, and everything was the same. Same parents, same friends growing up, everything. Except in that life, I played sports. A lot. In high school, I played basketball, baseball, football, and track. Sometimes I had to run straight from a track meet to a baseball game. I loved that. He cracked the beer open with a satisfying pshht sound. The University of Oregon recruited me, but told me they wanted me to concentrate on football, so I gave up everything else. I went to Oregon then, just like I did in this life, but I didn't study architecture. I mostly studied how to be a big man on campus while taking the easiest classes I could find. John was silent for a moment, reflecting. I'll be honest, I wasn't a very good dude. Too much success, too early, went to my head, and I was pretty certain my feces were of the non-smelly variety, if you know what I mean. Nathaniel smiled and nodded in understanding. I got drafted by the Oakland Raiders to play middle linebacker. I wasn't one of those first-round draft picks, but I still got enough money to do whatever I wanted, I guess. Problem was, I couldn't really think of anything I did want. I never got married, never had kids. He shook his head. I can't even imagine life without Melissa and Katie. That's probably why I'm not rich, but I am happy in this life, instead of having more money than sense in that one. Anyway, back then, we didn't know much about concussions and brain injuries and CTE. Not like we know now. Unconsciously, John ran his fingers through his close-cropped hair, as if feeling the impact of some of those blows across the lifetimes. I had 5 concussions. Or maybe I should say 5 registered concussions. A lot of times we just called it getting your bell rung, or a stinger. Whatever you want to call them, they added up, and they did something to me. Before I was even out of football, I was having trouble remembering defensive formations. 2 years after I retired, I had to write down my address in case I couldn't find my way home. That's bad enough, but there were worse things. I was angry all the time. I lashed out at everyone, but mostly anybody that tried to get close to me. One day I raised my hand to hit my girlfriend, and that was it. The look on her face stopped me, thank God. He drained off half the fresh beer in one long pull. I went straight home, typed up my suicide note, donating my brain to study the effects of all those concussions, then put a gun to my chest and pulled the trigger. Here's how lost I was. As I lay there on my bed, about to pull the trigger to kill myself, all I could think about was whether ESPN would interrupt their programming to announce I'd done it, or if it would just be a throwaway at the end of SportsCenter. John chuckled a little, but it was a bitter, tinny laugh. You'd think that would be the end of it, right? I should have gone on to whatever's next.
You would think, Nathaniel said.
But I didn't. The next thing I knew, I felt like I was falling. Here's the weird part. My mom reached out and caught me to keep from falling on my face. My mom, who had died almost 10 years before me. We were walking through the Safeway parking lot, and she reached out and caught me like it was no big deal. Like I had been there the whole time. It was like my whole life was given a do-over. It took me a while to wrap my head around it, I'll admit. Eventually, I figured out that I had been given a second chance. Although I have no idea why. He turned and looked at Nathaniel. 30 years later, I still don't understand any of it. But when I came to in my 10-year-old body, everything that had been wrong with me was gone.
No more headaches or uncontrollable anger. It really was a second chance. So I decided a couple of things. First, I would never step on a football field again. Second,